And we're ready. Okay, so our topic for tonight is an interesting little subtopic in the history of the Jews in the Civil War, and that is of Jewish army chaplaincy. Jewish army chaplaincy, and it's worth examining this topic because it turned out to be the first ever victory for the Jewish people in America in terms of fighting the federal government over issues of discrimination and being successful at it. That previously, there had been issues between Jewish residents or citizens and state governments, but never before had there been an issue of an impasse with the federal government, and this would be one where there was a successful outcome. Okay, so army chaplaincy is even older than the Republic itself. Army chaplaincy dates back to 1775 in the Continental Congress. But in the early years of the Republic, these chaplains were all Protestant, of varying Protestant denominations, but all Protestant. There was no discussion of Catholic chaplains until President James K. Polk arranged for a civilian chaplaincy, but no formal military appointment during the Mexican War. You know, the demographics of America had been changing so that by the 1840s, there was a serious need for Catholic chaplains. But even then, only at a sort of a private, informal method. It was not until the Civil War that Catholics were allowed to serve formally as army chaplains.
Oh, I forgot.
They're getting paid. Okay. So, one second. Okay. As for Jews, there was no discussion of the possibility of Jewish chaplains before the Civil War. But with thousands of Jews fighting for both the Union and the Confederacy, it was now a real question of whether Jews had equal rights in America, on the premise that the spiritual nurturing of soldiers and ministering to their earthly and not so earthly needs is a legitimate action to be taken by the government. Well, if you have Jewish soldiers, you got to cater to their needs. In the Confederacy, the law providing for the appointment of chaplains simply said clergymen without denominational identifier. Now, that's good. That means you don't have to be a goy. You could be a Jew and you could be a chaplain. Now, while there was no regiment in the Confederate Army with a majority of Jews that called for a Jewish chaplain, there was no legal impediment for appointing one. So no rabbi is known to have served as this Confederate Army chaplain, but they could have if it were desired. There was no legal impediment. In the North, however, in the Union, the Volunteer Bill, which was the basis for conscripting soldiers in 1861 and going forward for the war, called for chaplains to be voted upon by the field commanders and appointed by the commanding regimental officer. And this chaplain had to be a regularly ordained minister of some Christian denomination. Now, I ask you a question. By the standards of modern times, you know, 20th and 21st century, would that pass constitutional muster?
No.
No.
Oh, right. Because you can't have laws on the books that identify religions by name. Okay, you can't do that. And yet, in 1861, it was perfectly kosher in the eyes of a majority of the members of the House and Senate and signed into law. Now, that said, while the bill was being negotiated and debated on the House floor, an Ohio congressman named Clement L. Vallandigham, you never heard of him before, protested the formulation that mentioned Christian denomination. And he wanted the bill instead to read a religious society. Now, religious society is neutral. It's not Christian, it's not Jewish, it's not Catholic, it's not Muslim. Religious society, whatever that means. Now, Vallandigham was a leader of the Democrat Copperheads, which means he opposed the war. And in 1863, he was convicted by an army court-martial and exiled to the Confederacy. He then moved to Canada and ran for the governorship of Ohio from Canada and lost. So he's not exactly remembered fondly in the annals of American history, but by Jews he's remembered fondly because he said you can't have discrimination. He spoke out in favor of Jewish rights without having been prodded by Jewish constituents. Now, normally, when you have a Jewish member of the House or Senate who is very, very pro-Jewish and is known to be, it's typically because they come from a state with a lot of Jews and the Jews push their buttons all the time and are lobbying vigorously. And so the guy adopts a pro-Jewish policy. But this fellow, through no prompting by anybody else, he decided it's not right to have discrimination. He said there's a large body of men in this country, and one growing continually, of the Hebrew faith, whose rabbis and priests are men of great learning and piety, and whose adherents are as good citizens and true patriots as are any in this country. It's a very nice thing to say about American Jews, that they're as patriotic and loyal as everybody else. He considered the volunteer bill, as it was drafted, to be without constitutional warrant, because it assumes that America is a Christian nation, and it's not. There's separation of church and state. Vallandigham's objections were ignored by his colleagues, and they voted on the bill as it was initially formulated and passed it. And so, in 1861, some Christian denomination was the law on the books. What was the Jewish reaction to all this? So, Isaac Mayer Wise, a fellow Ohioan, was very pleased with Vallandigham. But for the most part, the episode passed unnoticed by the Jewish community. Wise did not suggest that Jews vigorously protest, in large measure because he was against the war, so he didn't want there to be a volunteer bill anyway. He simply suggested that in the next election cycle, Jews could square accounts. And as we'll get our vengeance on those dirty Republicans. And Wise almost ran as a Democrat for the state Senate. The editors of the Jewish Messenger, which was a newspaper printed by New York Jewry, by Samuel and Mayor Isaacs, they thought that the congressional ruling was an accidental oversight on their part. They thought they didn't mean to slight the Jews. It just worked out that way. But that's not true. Congress very much passed a pro-Christian version of the bill, knowingly so, and knowing that there were those people who opposed it and wanted a non-denominational version. Okay, so you'd figure now there are no Jewish chaplains, but you'd be wrong. In fact, there was one. So in September 1861, a YMCA worker happened to visit a Virginia encampment of the 65th Regiment of the 5th Pennsylvania Cavalry. And this regiment was known as Cameron's Dragoons. Now, Cameron was the Secretary of War. And this was a largely Jewish unit. Well, the YMCA fellow was shocked to see that the chaplain of this unit was Michael Mitchell Allen, a Jew. He complained to the higher powers that this was against the rules, and the army was going to be forced to dismiss Allen. So to save his honor, Allen resigned his military commission on the assertions of ill health rather than to suffer the embarrassment of a dismissal on religious grounds. His resignation was accepted by the Army of the Potomac on September 26, 1861. The issues of Jewish chaplains was once again at the forefront. So here you have a guy serving, but they find out he's a Yid, he's a Jew, fire him. All right, so Allen walks away. What happened? If it was against the rules, how did he get the appointment in the first place? Let me explain. Mm-hmm. So the fellows who appointed Michael Allen were not trying to break the law. They probably knew nothing of the details of a law which was passed just days before they appointed him. The commanding officer of the 65th Regiment was Colonel Max Friedman, a Jew. And many of the 1,200 fellows who were in this regiment were Jewish. So it made sense to have a Jewish chaplain. Maybe the only regiment in the whole army, whether north or south, where this actually made was eminently logical to have a Jewish chaplain. So who was this Michael Allen? He was born in Philadelphia in 1830, and he was a student of Isaac Leiser. He briefly studied for the ministry. He taught classes at the Hebrew Educational Society of Philadelphia. He substituted as chazan in the various synagogues of Philadelphia when Leiser was frequently out of town. He also led the davening as a substitute chazan sometimes up in New York, and he was the secretary of the United Hebrew Beneficial Society. In other words, he was an all-around good Jew, learned and involved in the civic life of Jewry. It was said that he was the only non-clergyman who could do the entire Portuguese liturgy from memory. Pretty good, daven for the Amid without a sitter. He was the best person in the regiment to serve as chaplain. And he was not merely the Jewish chaplain. He was chaplain for all members of that military unit, for people of all faiths. So what did he do? Well, on Shabbos and Jewish holidays, he went back to Philadelphia or Washington to lead services in the shul. But on Sundays, he'd be back at the army encampment to lead a non-denominational service for the soldiers every Sunday. What was in this service? Well, let me ask you this. Who has an idea? What do you do if you're a non-denominational chaplain in a unit of mixed Jews and Gentiles, but a lot of Jews, and you want to make a service that'll make everybody happy? What do you include in it? Tell me.
Peace, love, and motherhood.
Bingo. Okay, good. What else? What scriptural readings? What biblical readings?
Old Testament.
Old Testament, right. Psalm 23, Psalm 130, something like that. You know, something non-controversial. Proverbs 31 for the ladies. Whatever it is, but you're not going to read New Testament because that's going to offend the Jews, and you're not going to read the minutiae of Hilchos Tefillin. So you're going to read something that's palatable to all parties. Well, so what did his services include? Some pleasant scriptural readings, hymns, and a sermon. And the sermons were not overtly Jewish, and they didn't mention Jesus. Okay, so it could pass for either way. They were suitably neutral, but within the broader Judeo-Christian tradition. They were realistic and down-to-earth and suitable for the ears of soldiers in a war zone. He tried to uplift their morale and their morality. Reverence for the deity and love of the scriptures. He was endeared to all. They loved him. He was a great chaplain, but sadly he only served for 3 months, from July through September of 1861. It was said about him that he taught the word of God and had no sectarian hatred for others. That's an important point. No sectarian hatred. Halavai, we should all have no sectarian hatred. Okay? He even volunteered to teach English to those foreign-born soldiers who needed help. But Michael Allen was disqualified, not just for one reason, but for two reasons. He wasn't a Christian. And the law said you had to be a Christian. But secondly, he wasn't an ordained minister. He was a layperson, a learned one at that. He had studied with Isaac Leiser and Max Lilienthal for the rabbinate for a little while, but he had only attained the level of chaver. A chaver is someone who knows a little bit, you know, knows a fair amount, but he's not a rabbi. Okay? So there were those who objected to him being a chaplain said the man's not a clergyman. He's a liquor salesman by trade. Not that there's anything wrong with him being a liquor salesman, but he's not a rabbi. Okay. Furthermore, at this time in late 1861, it was the consensus of President Lincoln, members of the Army General Staff, and even the rabbis and upstanding ministers around the country that the chaplains were like the lowest of the low. The worst people became chaplains. They did it for the paycheck. Lincoln said, the worst men we have in the service. They were broken down old reverends long since out of the religion business because no respectable church would hire them. You have rabbis like that too. Now, Max Friedman decided to try again. You know, we tried to have a Jewish chaplain. They didn't let us. But we're going to try again. But this time, it'll be an ordained rabbi. So forget the issue of he wasn't ordained. It'll be an ordained rabbi. And it'll be someone who's a civilian, because Allen was just a soldier who was voted and appointed to be chaplain of the regiment in which he was actually fighting. But he was a soldier first. So they're going to go with a civilian who therefore is not afraid of losing his military commission because he doesn't have one yet. And the appointment process would go through the Secretary of War. So the highest levels, not that in the field some nobodies are appointing a Jew, but rather in Washington, among the head honchos, they're going to say that a Jew can be the chaplain. This way, if it was refused, and we'll see that it will be refused, it will be unambiguously known that there was religious discrimination against the Jews. So if the only objection was religious identity, not qualification, ordination, anything of that sort, it was only religious identity, we would know there's discrimination. Was this heavily Jewish regiment active in battles of the war? I'm not sure the answer to that. I don't believe so, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay. So who did they choose? They chose Arnold Fischel of New York City. Arnold Fischel of New York City. He would be the test case. And his appointment was going to be denied by the Secretary of War, Simon Cameron. It wasn't Cameron's fault, but there was no wiggle room within the law as it stood. And so things were in late 1861, that Arnold Fischel was requested to be appointed as chaplain of so-called Cameron's Dragoons, and because of his Jewish identity, he was refused. Who was Arnold Fischel? So now let's talk about who this Arnold Fischel was. He's a forgotten person in American Jewish history, but he shouldn't be forgotten because he played an important role. So Fischel was born in Holland, and he was Ashkenazic, and yet he would later go on to serve as a lecturer at Sherith Israel of New York, a Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Our first encounter with Fischel in the historical record is in 1849 in England, where he has no title. He's not a reverend. He's not a rabbi. He's not a doctor. Yet he was a man of high erudition, and he was traditionally Orthodox. And he's writing scholarly articles about biblical philology, and he's translating Mor Nevuchim. So he's a heavy hitter in terms of intellectual life. He later was addressed as Reverend Doctor, and we don't know where these degrees came from. Presumably they came from the Luft, from nowhere. He was hired in Portsmouth as a rabbi, and later in Liverpool. In 1856, he was voted as the lecturer and teacher at Sherith Israel in New York. This was very controversial, because Sherith Israel, for 200 years, only had a chazan, never had a rabbi. The chazan was the liturgical leader, and yes, gave speeches ever since the days of Gershom Mendes Seishas, and was considered a clergyman, but was not a rabbi. And now comes along Arnold Fischel, who's going to be much more scholarly in Judaism than J.J. Lyons was, who was the chazan, but they're going to bring him in as a preacher and teacher. Effectively, he was like the assistant chazan to Lyons, like an assistant rabbi. He gave sermons, he occasionally led the davening, he officiated life cycle events, and he taught classes. There's some ambiguity as to what his real first name was. He always signed his name A. Fischel. So we have 9 identifying records where he writes his first name out. 5 times it's Arnold and 4 times it was Adolf. So we're not really sure what his first name was. But let's assume it was Arnold. Okay. He was not a good orator. Because they didn't like his speeches, they made him read from notes. He was a good writer, and his lectures made for good written articles, but he was not the best of orator. He was a forceful advocate for the Union on the eve of the Civil War. In 1859, 60, and early 61, he forcefully argued in favor of the Union. What was his logic? His logic was that the federal setup that they have at that point had been good for the Jews, but that if the federal setup breaks down and the fate of the citizenry is going to be tied to the whims of the individual states, well, there's no guarantee that all these states are going to be so liberal as to give rights to Jews. So why rock the boat and upend a system that is workable and was working well for the Jewish people? Okay. He was a vigorous proponent of orthodoxy and traditional observance for Shmira Shabbos and Kashrus. He said reform is no good. In 1859 and 60, he published a bunch of articles about American Jewish history, including the first ever article about the 1654 New Amsterdam group and the earliest articles about Washington's letters to the Jews. He was so frum that he boycotted a banquet for Jews Hospital, which I think is what eventually became Beth Israel, if I'm not mistaken, because at the annual banquet, people ate with uncovered heads, bared heads. Oh yeah, Shanda, they ate without a yarmulke on, so he didn't go. So Fischel was not rehired by Sherith Israel in October of 1861. You know, they didn't renew the rabbi's contract. So he was available to serve as the test candidate for Cameron's Dragoons, for that Jewish unit from Pennsylvania fighting in Virginia that wanted a Jewish chaplain. So he applied to Cameron in October of 61 and was rejected on the technicality that he was not a Christian. In truth, however, Fischel was no more ordained than Michael Allen was, but nobody knew that. As far as they knew, he was Reverend Doctor and they thought he was a rabbi. Plus, he was really learned, so it looked good. He also wasn't an American citizen. However, American citizenship was not necessary to function as an army chaplain at that time. So Jews were not especially concerned with the constitutionality of the law, of the volunteer bill. They were more concerned with practical equality. Are we going to get what we want? Not is the law kosher in the abstract, but is there going to be fairness? Are we going to get what we deserve? So how do you achieve this? How do you achieve a change in policy if you tried with Michael Allen, they got rid of him. You tried with Arnold Fischel, they said no. What can you do? Any suggestions? What can they do?
Bring a case to court.
Bring a case to court. Okay, that's one possibility. What else?
Don't make waves.
Don't make waves. So that's exactly what the opposite of what they do. So
go to Lincoln.
Go to Lincoln. Good, good. So one thing is a publicity campaign in the Jewish periodical press and in the general press, decrying what they see and what really was an unfairness. Then flood Washington with petitions. So dozens of petitions in favor of a Jewish chaplain were sent, including those signed by many non-Jews. One such petition had 37 members of the New York State Legislature signed to it. Another one from Baltimore had 700 names. Another one from Bangor, Maine had 200 names, and Bangor, Maine at the time had 3 Jews living there. So mostly Goyim are signing these petitions, which is good. It reminds me of what happened during 1943 and 42 and 43, and into early 44, when prominent Gentiles would sign petitions by the Bergson Group, you know, by the Irgun in America, in favor of the rescue of Jews from Nazi-occupied Europe. Okay, so the Board of Delegates of American Israelites, which was founded in 1859 to be something of a representative body for American Jewry with lobbying in Washington, they appoint Arnold Fischel as their man to lobby for a change in the law. Fischel arrived in Washington on December 10th. How long do you think it took him to be able to see Lincoln? How long? Any guess?
One day.
Bingo, one day. So America today, it doesn't work like that. You know, but in the old days, if you wanted to see the president, you could see the president. You know, you march on the White House, you knock on the door, the secretary lets you in, and you see the president. That's how it was. So it's bizarre.
There was a time when there was audience, when people simply walked off the street and waited.
Yeah, yeah. So
that sounds like Andrew Jackson.
Or Theodore Roosevelt, who reputedly came down from his bedroom in his robe only to find a citizen waiting for him in the living room. I mean, apparently.
Yeah, that's the way it was. It changed after Woodrow
Wilson. Very, very hard to imagine, but that's how it was.
So he came to Washington on December 10th. And he was able to secure a very lengthy audience on December 11th with Lincoln, coming armed with a few letters of introduction from prominent New York Republicans. So New York Republicans was what pushed him through the door. The meeting went well. The meeting went very, very well. And on December 13th, he received the following note from Abraham Lincoln. And the note said the following: I find there are several particulars in which the present law in regard to chaplains is supposed to be deficient, all of which I now design presenting to the appropriate committee of Congress. I shall try to have a new law broad enough to cover what is desired by you on behalf of the Israelites. And notice, not the Jews, the Israelites. We're biblical. Okay, so basically, Lincoln is telling Fischel, I hear what you want. It's a reasonable request. I'm going to try to muscle it through Congress, and hopefully the law will be drafted in such a way as to satisfy what it is that you need. Okay. Now, having convinced the president, Fischel now had to convince Congress. So there was Protestant opposition. They said that to give a chaplaincy to a rabbi was the equivalent of America denying the lordship of Jesus Christ. Whoa, that's like tough language. That's fighting words. That America is supposed to be a Christian country and they accept Yashka. So if you give a military chaplaincy to a rabbi, it's like you're denying Jesus. Well, that's going to scare people. Okay, there are plenty of religious people, when they hear that kind of rhetoric, they're going to be afraid. Okay, but there's another group that also was against Fischel's agenda. And that was the Reform Rabbinate. So the Reform Rabbinate and the Meshuggah Protestant fundamentalists were in the same boat on this one. Why did the Reform rabbis oppose it? Any idea?
Fishel wasn't Reform.
Correct, but what in particular is potentially dangerous from a Reform Jewish perspective about the creation of a Jewish chaplaincy? Any ideas?
So also Reform, making waves?
What?
Making waves?
So the reason why there are 60 people listening tonight, and the reason why none of you get the answer right is because we live in America. If I was giving this class in England and you were all British Jews, you'd know exactly what the answer is right away instinctively. The answer is this. When you have a chaplaincy, it has to be, or at least it's logical, that there is going to be some kind of ecclesiastical body that will identify and certify who is considered a kosher Jewish clergyman. Okay, and in countries that have a chief rabbinate, whether it's the state of Israel or England or France or Russia or Venezuela, whatever you have it, so those things exist. There's official Judaism. But in America, is there official Judaism?
No.
Okay, so there's no official Judaism. There's just a free-for-all. It's a separation of church and state. So if there's going to be a Jewish chaplaincy, it's inevitable that some kind of
don't have a hierarchy.
Will come to exist. It'll come to exist. Okay, so therefore what happened? Rabbis Adler, okay, Einhorn, David Einhorn, Felsenthal, Hochheimer, Lilienthal, and Isaac Meir Wise all opposed Fishel's mission because they denied that the Board of Delegates was a representative Jewish agency, meaning they said there is no representative Jewish agency, certainly not the Board of Delegates. Now, in part, it's because those guys were not well represented in the Board of Delegates. There's a certain political angle to it. They wanted the power, not the other guys have the power. But even beyond that, there's the issue of a formal hierarchy of religion. So with all this in mind, there was opposition, you know, to Fishel's mission. He had the support of Lincoln. On March 12th, the Senate was won over. They abolished the old legislation, which was denominationally Christian. But the House had to go along for with the change, and then the president would have to sign a new law. So things got stuck because of the opposition. Meanwhile, Arnold Fishel was functioning as the unofficial chaplain, ministering to Jewish soldiers in the local hospitals in and around Washington. He supplied Siddurim and Tehillim, and conducted services from December through of 1861 through April of 1862. He was given $20 a week by the Board of Delegates to cover his expenses of, you know, doing things on behalf of the soldiers. But the money ran out, and appeals for funds went unheeded. So he's broke, and the Board of Delegates has no money to give him. So his mission abruptly ended in April. As a result, the legislative process, which he was greasing the wheels the whole time, moved even more slowly. It was not until July 17th that the new law was passed. Now, what did the new law actually say? Let me read it to you. So the new law said, that no person shall be appointed a chaplain in the United States Army that is not a regularly ordained minister of some religious denomination, so some religious denomination, and who does not present testimonials of his present good standing as such minister with a recommendation for his appointment as an army chaplain from some authorized ecclesiastical body with not less than 5 accredited ministers belonging to said religious denomination. In other words, the 5 ministers' business is that you can't be some lone freakazoid who's the, you know, a universal life minister who celebrates the Feast of Maximum Occupancy. You know, you can't be some whack job. You have to be from a denomination that has at least a critical mass of followers and is recognized in this country as reputable, okay? But ecclesiastical body, and that's what some Jews were afraid of. Okay, so that's the new law. And, all right, Jews can satisfy that requirement. Well, the Board of Delegates asked John Hay, who was President Lincoln's secretary, to make Fishel a Potomac area hospital chaplain. he was functioning in a capacity similar to that unofficially for months. It was denied when they realized that there were only seven Jewish patients out of 5,000 local hospital beds. In other words, there just wasn't a need for it. So he went back to Holland to live with his mother, and he spoke about returning to America in 1865, but he never did. Arnold Fischel died quietly in 1894 in Holland, 30 years removed from any excitement in his life. And your average American Jew never heard of him. But he's the one who fought the good fight to make sure Jews could have chaplains and that the law was not discriminatory in favor of Christians. Okay, so this was a big victory for the Jewish rights vis-a-vis the federal government. Now it's going to be the responsibility of the Jewish community to try to take advantage of these rights, to appoint someone and exercise the prerogatives of the chaplaincy. So the Board of Ministers of the Hebrew Congregations of Philadelphia requested that President Lincoln appoint a Jewish chaplain for the military hospitals in the city of Philadelphia and the neighboring region. The reason why Dafka there they should have a chaplain is because Jewish soldiers were dying without receiving the Jewish last rites of Shema Yisrael. And Philadelphia was a central depository of badly wounded Union soldiers, meaning from all over the country, they would shuffle them off to Philly, where whatever happened to them, hopefully they recovered. But there's a lot of Jews there, so let's have a Jewish chaplain. So Lincoln agreed, and the Board of Ministers selected Rabbi Jacob Frankel of Rodev Shalom Congregation of Philadelphia to be this military hospital chaplain, and Lincoln signed the commission on September 18th, 1862. So who was Jacob Frankel? Jacob Frankel was born in Bavaria in 1808. So he was 54 years old, but when he became the chaplain, he had a great voice. In Europe, before he came to America, he had a bit of a singing career, a musical career. Really, he was a cantor and not a rabbi. But then again, those kind of distinctions didn't matter much back in the 19th century. Chazan, rabbi, it's a clergyman all the same. He came to America in 1848 and served in Philadelphia until shortly before his death in 1887. He was the most popular and well-liked rabbi in the whole city. How do we know this? Because there was a rabbinic popularity contest for the support of the local Jewish hospital in 1866. And he had more tickets bought for him as the most popular local rabbi than all the other rabbis combined. So he was like a good chazan and a lovable character. Frankel was in the service for 3 years, from 1862 to 1865. He visited the hospitals, he ministered to Jewish patients, and he arranged furloughs for the Jewish holidays for patients mobile enough to get home. He loved his tenure, and he framed his commission, which was signed by President Lincoln and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. And we actually have that that framed commission because his great-granddaughter kept it. They were so proud of what he received. Take a look. Here it is. I don't know if you can see it. For Jacob Frankel, signed by Lincoln and Stanton. Okay. Now, there were two types of chaplaincies. One was regimental. You know, you were with a unit in the army out in the field. The other was hospital chaplaincy. In the scholarly literature, the regimental chaplaincy gets far more attention. It's juicier. You know, the bullets are flying, as opposed to the hospital where you just have patients moaning and groaning. Yet, the truth is, they were equally important. And whereas the regimental chaplain was appointed by the army commanders, the hospital chaplains were commissioned by the president himself. Okay, so actually one was a higher madrega than the other in terms of how you got the job. Both types of chaplains wore clergy garb, not the military uniform. This would change. Anyone who's seen pictures of, you know, World War II era Jewish chaplains knows that the rabbis and the chazanim, they all wore a regular army uniform. Yeah, they had a yarmulke on the head and the Persian talis, you know, the scarf talis on their shoulders, but they wore a regular army uniform. They were not wearing clergy garb. But in the Civil War, they wore the clergy garb. Okay. Now, Isaac Leiser suggested to the rabbis in New York, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Cincinnati, the other big Jewish communities, that they follow Philadelphia's example and ask the White House to appoint hospital chaplains. I mean, after all, the large Jewish community, soldier gets injured, they're going to get sent home, they're going to be in a local army hospital, they're going to need to be ministered to. So let's take advantage of the law as it's now formulated and get more Jewish chaplains. But for whatever reason, the other rabbis or rabbinic bodies in other cities dropped the ball, and nobody else did it. Only the guys in Philadelphia took care of business by appointing Jacob Frankel. Now, in October 1862, the Board of Delegates of American Israelites, there was one other hospital chaplain, Jewish hospital chaplain, and that was Bernard Henry Gotthelf. Bernard Henry Gotthelf was the rabbi of Adith Israel in Louisville, Kentucky. And he was appointed the hospital chaplain with a commission dated February 6, 1863. What's so special about a Jew being made a chaplain in Kentucky in February of 1863? Based upon what we learned last week, why might that seem a little bit surprising?
Order number 11.
Bingo. Order number 11 was signed not even two months earlier, expelling Jews from parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Southern Illinois, Mississippi. Okay. So on the one hand, you have the general of the army showing what might be regarded as vicious anti-Semitism, for which he repented and atoned, you know, we discussed last week. But still, if you thought that Grant's attitude towards the Jews was the universal attitude of all the local goyim towards the Jews, you'd be wrong. Because in Louisville, Kentucky, there isn't exactly the largest of Jewish communities. Yeah, there's a community, but it's not tremendous in size. And so there was no way that on their own, the Jews could have received a Jewish chaplaincy for one of their guys. How did it happen? It was secured with the help of the local population at large and United States House of Representatives Robert Mallory from Kentucky. So it shows Jews had friends in high places. Who was this Gotthelf? So Bernard Henry Gotthelf was born in Bavaria in 1819 and came to America in 1840. He served various congregations until his death in the yellow fever plague of 1878. We're going to see the yellow fever plague of 1878 was to American Reform rabbis what COVID-19 is in 2020 to American Orthodox rabbis. Okay. Asher has a comment. Several years ago, I served as a lay chaplain to the handful of Jewish prisoners in Nassau and Suffolk County jails. Okay. Was there such service provided by official Jewish chaplains in the Civil War period or ever since? So, yeah. So, prison chaplains have been around for the Jewish community since, I think, about the 1880s. I mean, the story that I remember best is from 1906, since we're talking about chaplains. Everyone, allow me to indulge for a second for a moment to tell you a little funny story that everyone from Anshei Shalom already knows this story. But in 1906, Israel Davidson was the chaplain at Sing Sing. Okay, now Israel Davidson was the professor of Jewish medieval literature at JTS, and he was poor, and he needed extra parnassa on the side. So he did the prison chaplaincy thing at Sing Sing to make a few extra shekels. And he was there for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and about a week after Yom Kippur, he gets called into his boss's office. Who is his boss? Louis Ginsburg, the professor of Talmud at JTS. Is the head of the faculty, basically. I mean, Schechter was the head of the seminary, but Ginsburg was Davidson's direct superior. And he says, Davidson, what did you do? I got a letter from a prisoner at Sing Sing saying that on Rosh Hashanah, you condensed the service. You ran a two-hour service. Now, in COVID, two-hour service already is kosher. But, you know, in 1906 in the prison, 2-hour service in Rosh Hashanah. It's a glatt treif service. How can you skip all these things? So Davidson said to Ginsburg, well, listen, it's a non-denominational chapel. They told me you have 2 hours. And then after you, the Catholics are going. And after you, after that, the Protestants go. So you have to get in and out of the room very quickly. So what did I do? I deleted the piyutim. You know, we didn't say v'chol ma'aminim. The non-statutory prayers we had to delete. So we did. So Ginsburg was satisfied with that answer. Okay, Davidson, it's a good answer. You did what you had to do. But this Jew who was so concerned that you skipped v'chol ma'aminim and some irrelevant piyutim, he sounds like such a fruma yid. What could he possibly have done to be deserving in jail? Maybe he made a mistake on his taxes, some petty little nothing. And Davidson said, no, he killed his wife. So that's one of the classic stories from prison chaplaincy, Israel Davidson, 1906. Okay. Now, back to gut health. So he was, he served for 3 years. And when he was appointed, it was heralded by the local newspapers as being richly deserved. He was of a great help to the German-speaking soldiers, even the ones who weren't Jewish. Because bear in mind, not all the chaplains could cater to immigrants, to recent immigrants. If you were a chaplain, a Protestant galach, and you spoke only English, but you had soldiers who were off the boat from Central Europe in the 1840s or 1850s, and their English was terrible, so the interaction was going to be not very good. Whereas if you were a rabbi or a Jewish minister, even though you were a Jew and the soldier or the patient in the hospital was a goy, but if you had common language, you could get the job done. Okay. So Gotthelf was famous for providing reading material in the German language to lift the spirits of those soldiers who didn't speak English. Okay. Only one rabbi actually served as a regimental chaplain, meaning not a hospital chaplain, but a regimental chaplain. And he's been forgotten by history for the most part. It's unfortunate. His name was Reverend Ferdinand Leopold Sarner. Ferdinand Leopold Sarner. On April 10th, 1863, Sarner enlisted in the 54th New York Volunteer Infantry and was immediately elected chaplain. Bear in mind that he was 43 years old at the time. He lied to the recruiters and told them that he was only 38 because he wanted to sneak under the wire. He was born in Posen in 1820. He went to the Posen. Remember, Posen is what country?
Poland.
So Posen is Germany by political affiliation, but Poland by culture. You know, it's historic Poland that became part of Germany. So the Jews of Posen tended to be fairly traditional, but the Jews of Posen also were becoming acculturated somewhat quickly in the middle 19th century. And so he started off a traditional education, but then he went to the Gymnasia. And from the Gymnasia, he went to the University of Berlin in 1851. And after the University of Berlin, he went to the University of Hesse in 1854. And he received a doctorate in 1858. So now he's the Reverend Dr. Sarner. He was elected rabbi in Battenfield in Germany in 1856. But in 1859, he comes to America. Why? Because America is the land of opportunity. He was a rabbi in Rochester from 1859 to 1860. And then he leaves. He's always bouncing around. He can't stay in the same place for more than a year. We don't know much about him from the years 1860 to 1863, other than he applied for the job at Anshei Chesed in New York in 1861 and didn't get the job. So the minutes have his name, but he didn't get the job. He wrote a travel log, which was printed in Isaac Meir Wise's Israelite for 1861, and it mentions that he was in the Capitol building in Washington. So he was making the rounds. He was a traveler. The 54th Regiment, which he joined, was known as the Hiram Barney Rifles. The Hiram Barney Rifles. The Civil War regiments had the greatest names. Where they got these names from is I have no idea, but the Hiram Barney Rifles. So Why would they hire a Jewish chaplain? Was it a majority Jewish regiment? That would seem to be the only logical reason for them to hire a Jew. Well, as it turned out, only 3 out of the 13 officers in that regiment were Jews. and the overwhelming majority of the rank-and-file soldiers were also not Jews. They were Gentiles. So why hire a Jewish chaplain? That's the major question.
So he was German-speaking, maybe.
Good, good. So it could be that there were so many German speakers, and Sarner was a graduate of German universities, that it wasn't so much his religious denomination that attracted them to him, or that impressed them, but rather his linguistic abilities and his academic credentials. You know, the German university is, that's the Leila Mikol Berchasa Vishirasa, you know, the German university. The army bookkeepers erroneously thought that Sarner was an ordained Lutheran minister. If you look in the army records and the literature in the American Jewish Historical Archives has this funny little anecdote, it says that Sarner was a Lutheran minister. Well, what, was he a Meshumah? Did he convert? Did he apostatize? No. What happened was they just made an error in their bookkeeping. But how could they make such an error that they would turn a rabbi into a galach? So one of two possibilities. Either it was just assumed by the army that a majority Gentile unit would not hire a Jew. So if he was German, it must be that he was a Lutheran. You know, Mestama, every German is a Lutheran. That's one possibility. The alternative is, no, he communicated with them, but his English was so poor that they didn't understand what he was saying. He was trying to say, I'm a Jewish rabbi, and all they heard was German gibberish, they said Lutheran. So those are some possibilities as to why, for the record keeping, they made such a mistake. Okay, so Sarner's unit saw action at Chancellorsville and at the Battle of Gettysburg, the all-important Battle of Gettysburg, and also in the invasion of South Carolina. So they were a busy bunch. Now, Sarner was injured at the Battle of Gettysburg. The Jewish Record newspaper reported the following, quote, Dr. Sarner is probably the first rabbi to voluntarily take part in a fight since Rabbi Akiva. I don't know if that's has any validity historically. He probably doesn't. But the idea is, you know, Rabbi Akiva was the great rabbi of the second century, who in the Bar Kokhba rebellion in the year 132 to 135 supported uprising against Rome, or so the legend has it. And so he fought the good fight. And so no rabbi has fought voluntarily since Rabbi Akiva now till Rabbi Sarner, Ferdinand Sarner, 1863. Okay, another Jewish newspaper reported the following, quote, Sarner's horse was killed under him, and he himself received a dangerous wound from which he subsequently recovered. This was the result of the very courageous manner in which he conducted himself during the terrible battle. So that's a classic trope from Civil War journalism that, oh, they shot at me, and the horse got killed, and the rider tumbled over and was injured. Plenty of Confederate generals, they say about them, oh, they shot the horse, and the horse died, and he fell off the horse. Okay, so, in fact, Sarner's wound did not heal right away. He was actually discharged from the army on October 3rd, 1864, retroactive to July 31st, 1864, on account of a physical disability. So out of the army and injured, what does he do? So Ferdinand Sarner went to New York and he had a few speaking gigs. Okay. He then tried to publish a German Jewish monthly, a literary periodical titled Rebecca, like sort of along the lines of Isaac Meir Wise's Deborah, which was also a monthly German Jewish periodical. But it was too religiously liberal for some people, notably Isaac Leiser, who didn't recommend it. He saw it and thought it was too unfrum. In Cleveland, while raising money for his publication, Sarner ran into some trouble because the local shul there had a board member who accused Sarner of faking his injury, saying, you're not a war hero, you're faking it. How do I know you're faking it? Because I saw you walking when you thought nobody was looking and you walked without a limp. So in truth, this was like motzi shemra, because Sarner really was injured and he really did have a walk with a limp. I'm reminded when the guy says, you're not really injured, of that scene, Lahavdil, in the movie The Big Lebowski, where Walter Sobchak, played by John Goodman, tells Jeffrey Lebowski, the older one, you're not really disabled, and he throws him out of the wheelchair. You know, it's not nice. So Sarner went to Memphis in 1872 and served as a rabbi there until his death in 1878. And how did he die? In the yellow fever of 1878. All the Reform rabbis, it was like their COVID. They plotted 1878 from the yellow fever. Okay, so that's the story of the Jewish chaplains in the Civil War. Now, one of the things that we learn from this is Jews are ready and willing to serve their country in whatever capacity they can. It's only a question of, will the opportunity present itself? And when it came to chaplaincy, the Jews pushed the envelope. The opportunity was not there, but they insisted that it be there. And Jews learned their lessons in terms of communal advocacy that would serve them in good stead in the decades to follow. But although the Board of Delegates of American Israelites was functioning, it didn't have as the kind of power that the later Jewish alphabet soup organizations would have. So it's not going to be until 1906 with the establishment of the American Jewish Committee where you're really going to have strong representation in Washington on a organizational basis, as opposed to a lone wolf, literally wolf, Simon Wolf, operating out of Washington, or Arnold Fischel on a mission to convince the president and Congress to do his bidding. Sole operators have limited capacity for success. You're going to need to have the organizations of the 20th century to get those sorts of things done. Okay, now, as for the Jewish soldiers themselves and their experiences in the Civil War, so just to spend a few minutes on that. Jews fought on both sides. Probably about 1,000 Jews fought for the Confederacy, maybe 10,000 or 12,000 Jews fought for the North. This was a war for which basically you had to volunteer. And it was a sign of patriotism to volunteer. People tended to support their region of the country. There were not too many people who switched sides, whose allegiance was to a cause not of their sector, their geographic sector of the country. So Southern Jews fought for the Confederacy with valor, and Northern Jews fought for the Union with valor. And some died, and they would be buried not necessarily in Jewish cemeteries, but in military cemeteries where the identifying marker on their grave would hopefully not be a cross, but it had to be known to the military that this person was a Jew and therefore not to put a cross on their grave. Was there a system of dog tags, the likes of which you had in World War II, where there were clear identifiers of religious denomination? Not exactly. There was a rough idea of who was Jewish, but it was not nearly as systematized as in later wars. There's a question from iPad 3. There were draft riots in not NYC, so not all soldiers were volunteers. Yeah, there, so in the Union, you had a draft, and there was great reluctance to participate in the draft in certain cities that didn't like fighting the war. There were plenty of northern locations where the war was unpopular, New York being one of them. But in other regions of the country, especially in Pennsylvania and Ohio, you had people volunteering in large numbers to prove their worth as citizens. Okay, so the war comes to an end in 1865. Now, next week, I'm going to discuss Lincoln and the Jews, the specific relationship of President Abraham Lincoln with the Jewish community. But just to discuss what happens to the Jewish community, the Jewish community was becoming more and more Americanized as the war went on. Now, why is that? In part because immigration basically comes to a halt during the war. People are not crossing the ocean during wartime. And what keeps the community an immigrant community is the constant influx of new arrivals. When you have the new arrivals come to a halt, even if it's just for a half a decade, you don't have greenhorns anymore. You have people who have been in the country for some time. Linguistically, they've acclimated themselves, and culturally, they've fit in. They've acculturated. So, when the war is over, there's a real desire for full Americanization and integration, which means the building of large synagogues, cathedral synagogues, the showing of wealth, of opulence, the likes of which wasn't seen before the war. And the style of the synagogues are going to become more reform and less immigrant orthodox. Now, lav dafka, because theologically they're moving from orthodoxy to reform, it's more of a cultural thing. It's that orthodoxy is immigrant religion. But if you're not an immigrant anymore, and you speak fluent English, and you've had the experiences of being a soldier in the war, or living through a half a decade of American hostilities, so you're a different person than you were in the 1850s when you were off the boat, when you were a brand new yekke. Okay, there was a question from the chat for fewer than the 10,000 who served in the Civil War. So remarkably, even then, the Jews could muster. Overall, the Jewish population in the country was 250,000. How about that? So actually, the Jewish population in the country in 1860 is assumed to be about 150,000. And it's about 250,000 20 years later in 1881. In 1881, at the beginning of the great wave of immigration from Eastern Europe, it's assumed to be at about 250,000. If you want to know the exact numbers, so it's assumed that in 1860, it was about 150,000. In 1850, it was about 50,000. In 1840, it was about 25,000. In 1820, it was about 5,000.
So it makes it even more remarkable then.
Yeah, well, but bear in mind that the Jews stood out as the only significant non-Christian denomination.
Yeah.
People had their eyes on the Jews, not necessarily a jaundiced eye. It could be they had a favorable attitude in some cases, like we saw in Kentucky, where they wanted the guy to become a chaplain because they liked him. Right. So Jews are eminently likable, you know, when they behave properly. And the Civil War proved that. Yes, there was plenty of anti-Semitism during the Civil War period, that the Jews were guilty of smuggling and of providing shoddy manufactured goods for the military. That's another thing. Shoddy manufactured goods. Shoddy, S-H-O-D-D-Y, was a classic trope against the Jews. But, you know, for all the criticisms and the hatred in some quarters, a lot of people were perfectly fine with Jews and interacted well with them in the course of the war. Any questions? Question.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, barely.
Okay. Two things. One is I looked up the Jews' hospital. It was the original Mount Sinai.
Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai. Yeah, yeah.
You in a very interesting email because it was located, guess where?
Where?
66th in Lexington.
66 in Lexington?
Yeah.
Where the armory is?
I believe so. But the other thing is, I want to put in a good word for my namesake, Michael Allen.
Yeah.
Because I think, since he was a liquor salesman, at least they could have considered him to be a spiritual leader.
Say goodnight, Jason.
That's true. Thank you, Michael. That was a good one. Okay. All right, everybody. On that note, a good night, and we'll see each other next week.
Thank you. Hazak Baruch.
Take care.
Be well.